poverty in America. It's all around us. We see it, and more often than not, we look away. This gives an opening for new technology like data analytics and sophisticated algorithms to deal with deeply human stories of survival, handling unique circumstances in ones and zeros. Data sets, managing poverty in America. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Virginia Eubanks is an associate professor of political science at the University at Albany SUNY. Her new book is titled Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. Virginia, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kate. It's great to be here.
Well, you look at poverty through a different lens than the way that we're used to looking at poverty. What is your relationship with poverty in this country?
So this book really started, I come out of the Community Technology Center movement, and I've been an organizer for economic human rights for about 15 years. But in 2000, I was working on building a technology lab in low-income housing in Troy, New York, which is my home. And I was sitting with a young mother on public assistance, and we were talking, just sort of shooting the breeze about technology one morning. And I had asked her about her EBT card, which is the electronic benefits transfer card, the card that you get benefits on in, I think, now all states in the United States. And I said, you know, people seem to really like these. It seems like it is less stigma than using paper food stamps at the store. It seems like it's more convenient. And she said, oh, yeah, well, it's true. There's a lot of things about that card that are great. But then she stopped and she said, you know, but my caseworker uses it as a way to track all of my spending. And I must have had this like really shocked look on my face because she kind of laughed at me. And then she got really serious for a second and she said, oh, you know what? You all, meaning professional middle class people, you all should pay attention to what's happening to us because you're next. And that's really the moment that I became really interested in the relationship between technology and poverty, and particularly technology and the public assistance system in the United States. And that was 18 years ago. So that's very much the starting point for this book and this journey for me.
How has this individual's life been exposed in ways that someone right now in the middle class may not be exposed, who is not in a social safety net program? In what ways have they been tracked, if you will?
Yeah, so the argument of the book is that we're building actually a digital poorhouse with these sort of integrated databases and predictive models and analytics and big data in our public service systems. And so we see some of the most invasive and punitive systems in the country first show up in public assistance. And it's really important to say, when I talk about poor and working class people in the book, I'm actually talking about the majority of people in the United States. So even though we have this idea that only a tiny percentage of people and people who are probably pathological fall below the poverty line, it's simply not true. The facts are that 51% of us will dip below the poverty line at some point between the ages of 20 and 64, and a full two-thirds of us will use means-tested public assistance. So that's not school lunches, that's not Social Security, that's straight welfare. So we don't all experience poverty equally. Your race, the number of children you have, whether or not you have a disability, has a lot of impact on whether you'll be poor and how you recover from poverty after you dip below the poverty line. But these issues are already a majority issue in the United States. But I do think it's really important to look first at these places where there's a low expectation that folks' rights will be respected, because that's where you see some of the, I think, most dangerous and important systems being tested before they're sort of rolled out to the rest of the country.
What really surprised me about your book is that some of these systems in place have been around longer than computer technology has been sophisticated. And you reach back to the 1960s and the national welfare rights movement saying that, you know, poor people should have constitutional rights, but that also there was this juxtaposition there that also there should be a lot of tracking and a lot of making sure that people are getting only what they quote unquote, deserve. How did that movement factor in to where your book went?
Yeah, that's an incredibly important moment in this whole story, and it was a huge surprise to me. So when I first started doing this work in my own home state of New York, I thought, you know what, let's see when these digital tools turned up. And I was assuming that they would have been integrated into the public service system in the 90s around the welfare reforms of 1996, or maybe in the 80s when sort of desktop computing became available to these offices. But the great surprise was that actually these systems, both in my home state and federally, date back to the late 60s and early 70s. And it turns out that moment's really important because, as you said, there's this huge, powerful, successful welfare rights movement working at just that moment. And one of the things they were pushing back on and winning was they were pushing back against the discriminatory eligibility rules that have blocked most people of color and most never married women from receiving public assistance. So they won all of these court cases that basically established equal access to these programs. And because they had established equal access, the welfare rolls started to rise. Now, they never reached even 50% of families under the poverty line. So it's important to say that, right, this wasn't a massive wave, but it was a significant change in the number of people who had access to these programs. At the same time, though, there's a backlash against the civil rights movement, which is what the welfare rights movement came out of, and there's a recession. And so public officials get sort of trapped between this rock and this hard place. So the professional middle class is engaged in a backlash against these gains by the welfare rights movement. But the welfare rights movement has established people's legal rights to equal access to programs. So that's actually the moment where you see these tools start to appear in public assistance. Is 1969, 1970, 1971. And they actually roll out first in the states that that had historically had the most discriminatory eligibility rules. And so that's really the sort of soil out of which these new tools grow. And I argue in the book that they represent more of an evolution than a revolution, even though we tend to talk about these tools as disruptors. They're actually very much in keeping with the history of poverty management in the United States.
Virginia Eubanks is with us. Her new book is titled Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. How has poverty impacted your life? Have you struggled in using systems in place that are designed to help? Has technology played a role in how challenges in your life were handled? 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's look at this digital poorhouse, this idea that you established in the book, the rise of the digital poorhouse. What were the goals behind this quote unquote digital poorhouse, and what are the problems that it poses?
So I use the metaphor of the digital poorhouse to sort of ground these like sparkly new tools in history. So I really start the book at the point of the rise of the brick and mortar poorhouse, the actual county poorhouse in the United States, which happened in the early 1800s in response to a huge economic dislocation, the Depression of 1819. And the reason that this is a key origin story is because there was a really distinct logic to poorhouses. There was a distinction between poverty, which is the sort of lack of resources, and what economic elites at the time called pauperism, which was dependence on public benefits. And this should sound really familiar to us right now. We're having these debates again right at this moment. The idea among elites was that the problem was not poverty, it wasn't economic dislocation, it wasn't the economy more broadly, it was dependency on public benefits. So in order to receive public benefits, you had to agree to basically enter voluntary incarceration in an institution that was meant to contain the poor. And you had to give up a number of your basic rights. So if you had the right to marry and vote, you had to give up those rights in order to enter the poorhouse. You were separated isolated from your children, and often you risk your life because death rates at poorhouses could be upwards of 30% a year. So this is sort of the moment in our history where we decide that public benefits should be more about moral diagnosis and diverting all of the people who might be undeserving of support rather than building a universal floor under everyone. And I think we can see that we are undergoing exactly the same moment right now. This conversation about hammocks, not trampolines, it sounds very familiar to me as a historian of poverty.
Or categorizing the deserving poor, and that's having these unintended consequences, you say.
Absolutely, and it's very expensive and it's very time consuming to try to separate whose poverty might be their own fault from other people who can be seen as totally morally blameless. And let me give an example. So I talk about three cases in the book. I talk about an attempt to automate all the eligibility processes for the welfare systems in the state of Indiana in 2006. I talk about an electronic registry of the unhoused or the homeless community in Los Angeles County that was piloted in 2013. And I talk about a statistical model that's supposed to be able to predict which children might be victims of abuse or neglect in the future in Allegheny County, which is the county where Pittsburgh is in Pennsylvania. So let's just talk briefly about the Indiana case. So in 2006, then governor of Indiana, Mitch Daniels signed what was eventually a $1.4 billion contract with a coalition of high-tech companies, including IBM and ACS, to automate and privatize all the welfare eligibility processes for the state. And the system was built on this sort of deeply ingrained assumption that any kind of relationship between frontline caseworkers and the families they served was an invitation to collusion and fraud. So the system was explicitly built to sever those connections. And how they did that is they moved 1,500 public local welfare caseworkers from their county offices to privatized regional call centers. And what that meant is that caseworkers were no longer responsible for like a docket of families whose cases they saw through from the beginning to the end. They just were responsible for the next task that dropped into their queue and sort of a computerized work management system. So that meant that no one was responsible for a case from beginning to end, and any recipient or any applicant for services, every time they called the call center, they spoke to somebody different. So they had to go through these processes over and over again. And that had really devastating effects on families. There was a million benefits denials in the first 3 years of the project, which was a 54% increase from the 3 years prior to the automation. And the stories of folks who struggled to keep their resources are really heartbreaking, right? So I talk about the family of Sophie Stipes, a six-year-old girl who lost with cerebral palsy, who lost her Medicaid for what was called failure to cooperate in establishing eligibility. I tell the story of Omega Young, an African-American woman in Evansville, Indiana, who missed an appointment to recertify for Medicaid because she was in the hospital suffering from terminal ovarian cancer, and was then denied for failure to cooperate in establishing eligibility. And this sort of category, failure to cooperate, basically just meant that someone somewhere in the process had made a mistake. It might have been the applicant, it might have been the call center worker, it might have been their document scanning center, but any mistake that was made on the application was seen by the system as an affirmative refusal to comply in the process of establishing your eligibility for the problem, for the program. Sure. And it really just had absolutely devastating effects on poor and working families in the state.
Virginia Eubanks is the author of the new book, Automating Inequality. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Albany, SUNY. Gathering your questions, your insights on data and society, 800-642-1234. How do we humanely use automation and computerization in safety net services? How do you best match need to resources and do it in the budget that's allotted? How has poverty touched you? Have you struggled in using systems in place designed to help? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. The statistic that sticks out in the book, at least half of Americans will spend at least a year below the poverty line between the ages of 20 and 65. It's a statistic that author Virginia Eubanks brings up to drive home this idea that these sophisticated computer systems for things like SNAP or Medicaid, for instance, may not be someone else's issue across town or next door. They could be our own issue. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Virginia Eubanks is an associate professor of political science at the University of Albany SUNY. Her book is Automating Inequality. Getting your insights as well at 800-642-1234. Has technology had a role in how challenges in your life were handled? Do you worry about automated systems taking the humanity out of how we care for people in America? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go to Susan, who's been waiting in Milwaukee. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
The thing that I have experienced in my own life is that although I worked for 35 years in the food industry as a pastry chef, a baker, in restaurant work, that kind of thing, there was only one job that I had for 5 years when I had insurance, and that was because I worked for the Grocers Union 1444. And I think a lot of this pointing at people relates to women and children. And that's my comment.
Susan, thank you for calling in. And Virginia, your reflections that this is a system hurting women and children.
Yeah, Susan, thank you so much for sharing your experience. And you're not alone. You know, everybody's case is unique, but there, you know, there's so many people who share your struggle. And I think it's so important that we share our stories with each other. So thank you so much for being willing to do that. You know, it's really interesting. I've talked a lot about this, about the book. I spend a lot of time talking about both race and class in the book. But there's some ways that I don't actually talk specifically about gender. And I think part of it is because it's so much sort of the water in which this fish moves, right? Like these systems impact folks who care for other people more than they impact those who don't. So folks who are caring for elderly parents or folks who have a child who is at home longer than others because they have a mental health issue or a physical disability. This work mostly falls on women. And these programs, when they are working well, should be supporting women and other caregivers to make sure that everybody is accommodated and welcomed in our community, and that everybody's human capacities are available to our culture and our country. So I think it's really, really important, Susan, to point that out, that these systems really mostly land on women and children, though increasingly also on single dads.
Virginia, going back to the Indiana situation on automated decision making there, 2006, $1 billion spent on a system. That's a lot of money in 2006. How have we seen these types of mega systems to govern over whatever it is in social safety net programs? How have they been scaled up since over the last decade?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what happened in Indiana is actually really, it's an incredibly compelling story in a lot of ways. It was a huge contract, and the intention was for it to be $1.4 billion. The contract was actually canceled by the state 3 years into this experiment. And then IBM, who was the lead contractor, actually sued the state for breach of contract. And in the first round of legal cases, actually won against the state and was awarded, not only was allowed to keep the first $500 million that had already been paid out to them, but was awarded an extra $50 million in penalties. Now, that case is still ongoing and it hasn't been finally decided, sort of, I think, close to 10 years later. But the cost of these systems can be incredibly high. And it's not just the original contract, right? So there were only two bids on this contract. One of the corporations dropped out, so it became sort of a no-competition contract. But the cost isn't just in the contracts and the maintenance of these systems, but also costs when these systems fail are incredibly high. So this ongoing 10-year legal case that tries to apportion blame for who sort of ruined this system is ongoing, is costing taxpayers of Indiana money every day. And importantly, the folks who lost their benefits, if you're told by the system that you no longer qualify for Medicaid, it's likely that you're going to trust that the computer made the right decision and that you're just not going to get medical care. And that is a cost that should not be borne by anyone. And it is a cost that's impossible to recoup, whether or, you know, no matter how the legal case turns out. So the cost of these systems can be quite high, both financially and in human terms.
Eric from Viroqua called in, couldn't stay with us. He says automating the system and moving paperless hurts people who need assistance. He asks, if you can't afford a computer, how are you supposed to do everything online? He says he tries to use the library, but half of the time those computers are all full. Virginia, yeah. How would you respond to that? Because
Eric, I hear you. Like, so this was also something that happened in Indiana, which is Indiana relied in. So this is 2006, and only 50% of low-income households in 2006 had access to the internet at home, right? So 50% of the people who were eligible for these programs had no access to the electronic forms that they had to fill out in order to get benefits. So the state of Indiana relied on what was called the VCAN network, which was a voluntary community something something network. And that basically meant that local nonprofits had to step in without remuneration and fill the gaps when the state withdrew. So the library was hit really badly by the sort of uptick in people needing to access their computers to access public assistance. It was a huge concern for them around privacy and confidentiality, because if people weren't able, didn't have the technological skills or had vision impairments, they had to actually read their application out loud. So there's social security numbers, there's mental health issues, there's your medical reporting in those forms. So they were really concerned, not only that they were asked to be doing work they weren't being paid for and they weren't being trained for, they were also being asked to do work that sort of conflicted with their basic values around privacy and confidentiality as librarians. So this is, it's a huge issue just in and around actual just access to the electronic resources.
Let's go to Donna now in Oshkosh. Hi, Donna.
Hello, good morning, and thank you for taking the call. Wonderful program. I would like to just bring to your attention that I live on a very fixed income. I'm 82 years old. I'm still paying property taxes, of which are $3,000 a year for my modest home. And I've been paying property taxes since I was 17 years old when we bought our first home. This causes quite a strain, because how can I maintain my home? I need to keep repairs up. I need a new driveway. I'm going to be putting in new windows upstairs this year, which are $3,000 in themselves just for three windows. And this draw, it makes us poor. You know, when we have to do this sort of thing, it seems that there should be a cutoff. That if you pay property taxes for so many years, or in the state of Wisconsin, we have people leaving the state because they don't want to pay property taxes on retirement.
Donna, so, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for that call. And Donna really showing how easily someone could fall into poverty.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it really, Donna, thank you so much for sharing your story. It's really important to understand that after sort of 50 years of targeting the programs that mostly serve poor and working class households, so welfare, homeless services, child protective services, the architects of these systems are now aiming at what I think of as middle class entitlements. So programs like Social Security, disability, unemployment, and Medicare. So if you look at the Trump administration's new budget, there's been a lot of talk about the cuts that are in that budget, and those are important. We should pay attention to those. But one of the things that's in there that I haven't heard as much conversation about is the administration proposes to save $189 billion in those middle-class entitlement programs over the next 10 years by ferreting out fraud, reducing improper payments, and improving program integrity. And that what they mean is by collecting and sharing more data, including buying data from commercial data brokers. And so it's not to say that fraud and efficiency, fighting fraud and increasing efficiency are not important parts of the job that government should be doing. But when we get into these sort of anti-fraud arms races, like a program like SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps, has a 1.3% fraud rate. And when we look at these systems that are set up to interrogate applicants for possible fraud, there is a point at which this sort of anti-fraud arms race just becomes a diversion from getting the resources that folks are entitled to. And so I think what I would suggest to Donna is the kinds of techniques and strategies that we've seen used to divert people from getting public assistance can also start affecting the programs that our elders rely on, like particularly Social Security. And we really need to pay attention to that.
If you're just joining us, the book is Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. Virginia Eubanks is with us. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Virginia, you come into your own book, speaking of fraud, how you share your story, how your family was red flagged for fraud. Can you tell us about what you learned about this issue going through it yourself?
Yeah. So right as I was working on sort of the final draft of the book, my much beloved partner of 14 years, Jason Martin, was walking home from the corner store to our house one evening and was attacked and beaten really badly by four guys we were never able to identify. And part of his recovery involved some really extensive facial reconstruction and plastic surgery. And it was a horrifying experience in many ways. But one of the parts that was worse for me, at least, was right after his surgery, I went to pick up his pain medication at the pharmacy, and the pharmacist said, "Oh, we canceled that prescription because you don't have health insurance." And I had had health insurance the day before, so I was very surprised and panicked by this. I ran home, I called my insurance company, and they said, "Oh, you're missing a start date in your coverage, so we don't have you as currently having health insurance." And I said, "You know, that's odd, because a week ago we had coverage." And they said, "Oh, it must just have been a mistake. Like, somebody must have accidentally erased your start date in the database, and you know, we'll work it out." But I had been doing this work for a long time by then, and I started to really suspect that we had been red flagged for an insurance fraud investigation, because the coverage was brand new. It was like a week old, and we had put in close to $70,000 of claims after his attack and the surgery. So we fought back, and we did win, and our coverage was reinstated. But what that really underlined for me is both how lucky my partner and I are, because we had community resources to help us through that period of time. My employer went to bat for me and made sure that our benefits were restored. I had all kinds of discretionary time to spend all day on the phone with the insurance company for 2 weeks. But if we had been fighting on any other front at that time, like if we had also had to interact with Medicaid, or we had also had to interact with Child Protective Services, or we had also had to interact trying to get our food stamps, would have been much, much, much more difficult to recover. So again, this is a case where these systems don't impact us all equally. We recognize we had a lot of privilege in this situation that helped us recover, but they do actually impact us all. And I think one of the moments of optimism in my book is as these systems scale up and become more embedded, I believe that people are going to start seeing their experiences mirrored in each other. And this can really be a place where we can build alliance and solidarity and push back against the worst of these systems, which is what happened in Indiana successfully, is that people organized against it and they forced the governor to cancel the contract.
Let's bring in David now, who is joining us from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Oh, yeah, hi. I'm not too far north of Silicon Valley, and this is where many of these problems are coming from. You know, it's interesting. I'm glad your guests are laying out that last example, as well as the earlier caller's example, raises the issue of commerce in souls, where basically everything about us is being bought and sold. And these corporations actually have a vested interest in dragging you through investigations, because then they can gather more data on you, and the more data they gather on you, the more they can sell it. And it's not as if they're going to provide a service anymore. They really make their money gathering data on you and selling it. So if the government is making a policy of buying and selling its taxpayers' information for added income, it subverts the very purpose of that the government has a duty to protect its own citizens. But the one issue I was going to raise was, on your dollar bill, it says this is good for all debts, public and private. And when the poor are forced to get onto these electronic payment systems, out here in San Francisco, general assistance requires you to get on a credit card or a debit card that is with one of the more corrupt banks, Bank of America. And so Bank of America will not allow you to withdraw money without giving them a service fee. And so when you start looking at the percentage, they're getting about 10% of the welfare budget. The bank itself is getting a cut of the, and so when the politicians complain, oh, well, there's billions going to welfare, well, just deduct 10%, and that's going to the bank.
Well, David, you bring up a number of issues that Virginia can respond to, from data gathering, data mining, to electronic money systems. Virginia.
Yeah, I'm so glad, David, that you raised that. That's certainly, EBT fees have certainly been something that folks on public assistance and their advocates have been really concerned about for a long time. And so I think, right, we've laid out a couple of things already that are super important to keep our eye on around these systems. One is, do they act to, you know, divert people from resources they're eligible for and deserve, the resources they use to keep themselves and their families safe and healthy. The second, I think, is David's point, which is, and also, I forget whether it was Eric who was talking about the contracts. It also is keeping an eye on the reality that there are people make money on these systems, right? So folks may be losing resources. We need to think a lot about what these systems actually cost, because to build these systems well, they're actually incredibly expensive. And to build them poorly, they become incredibly expensive in the human cost, right? So whether we're building them well or poorly, they're very expensive. And we need to think about, are they more expensive than the programs that they're increasingly trying to make more efficient? And then I think the third thing, which we haven't talked about yet, and I'd really like to raise, is sometimes these systems act block people from constitutional rights that are established in these programs. So in the book, I talk about Lindsay Kidwell in Indiana. And Lindsay was receiving Medicaid after the birth of her first child, Maddox. And about 2 months after the birth of her son, she received a notice that she'd have to recertify for Medicaid, which is totally normal. And so she went through the process of recertifying. But one of the things that was complicated in her case is that her partner had a job, but was getting paid not by like a regular paycheck, but by bank check. And the only thing the system understood as establishing your income was a pay stub off of a paycheck. So they didn't have one. So she called the system and she said, how should we establish our income for our application? And they said, oh, you know, write a list of paychecks and have the boss write a list of paychecks and amounts and send it into the document center. So they did that. And then they got this notice that said they had been denied because of a failure to establish income verification for the program. So in a panic, she calls back and says, you know, we did that. She's talking to a new person at the call center now. The new person says, oh, we don't need that. We need you to actually photocopy all of your canceled checks. So she runs around. She finds, you know, several months worth of canceled checks. She faxes them into the document center. Within the 10 days, she's given to correct this problem, and she's still denied. So she calls back, and they say, we still don't have any verification of income for you. And she said, no, we've talked about this several times. Mm-hmm. We don't have pay stubs. This is the story. And at that point, she did a really smart thing, which she said, you know what, I think you're making the wrong decision here, and I want to claim my right to a fair hearing, which is administrative procedure outside the welfare system, where an administrative judge makes a decision whether the state has made the right decision about eligibility or not. So she gets a call a couple of weeks later to schedule her hearing. But this third person who calls her from the call center says, you know, I'm here to schedule your hearing, but I got to tell you, I'm looking in the computer. I'm seeing what the judge is going to see. We have no evidence that you verified your income. The judge is just going to say no. So you should cancel your request for a fair hearing right now. Mm. And she amazingly had the strength and courage to push back. And she said, no, right? Like, I believe you made an incorrect decision and I want my fair hearing. But we see often these systems having that kind of impact on these established rights that people have within public service programs, that they sort of block the processes by which we've had due process in the past. So people don't only lose the resources they need to keep their families healthy and safe, but they also lose established rights. And I think that's something we should care deeply about as a democracy.
Virginia Eubanks has worked in community technology and economic justice movements for a couple decades now. She studies data and new technology, the role that data plays in allocating resources to people living in poverty and working class families. The book is Automating Inequality. How do you feel we have arrived at this point where data calls the shots? Does data call the shots? Do you think high-tech tools should be scaled up to allocate resources with less human caseworking? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll return to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. These scalable data systems were set up decades ago. Over time, the technologies leaned on this promise to streamline America's welfare system. These would be automated systems that gauge someone's eligibility for, say, SNAP benefits, databases that match homeless people to the resources they need, tools that collect and share lots of data to pick up patterns like cases of child abuse. Author Virginia Eubanks studies these technologies. Her new book explores the ways they can sometimes compromise the rights of the people they're meant to lift up. She's an associate professor of political science at the University at Albany SUNY. She stays with us for the conversation. Her new book is Automating Inequality, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has technology played a role in how challenges in your life were handled? Let's go to Rob now, who's waiting in Milwaukee. Hi, Rob.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I was listening, and I actually worked in Indiana for a few years at the food bank and was part of a statewide committee that introduced electronic benefits. And I look back at it now, we were sold a book of goods that was very untrue. It was supposed to be more money going into the community, not less, because it would cost less and would save money. And I was the only person representing the public on this panel, this committee of about 30 people. There were a lot of bankers, and the banks got paid before anybody got paid. They got paid for so many transactions for just putting the money on the account, and then they got paid for the person having the card open, and then they got paid for every transaction that the person made. Those transactions didn't show up on the person's card, though. Those were contracts with the state for each card that was issued. And the pilot program was in like 3 counties, and then it spread across the state. And I look back at it now, and the same thing happened with the licensing or the introduction of the lottery system across the country. We were told it would improve our educational system, that it would be added to the educational system, and it didn't get added to it. It went in place of, so the money got shifted to somebody else and not people in the community. So I thought I should share that with you because it's right on what you're talking about.
Well, Rob, thank you. Virginia, reflections from someone who was there on the ground.
Rob, thanks so much for your really important work and for sharing your experience with us. I think often that these systems are really compelling sort of windows on what we believe politically. And I'd say sort of at this moment, we're really trapped in this politics of austerity, this idea that there's not enough. And what I think is really important, Rob, about what you're saying is you're making it really clear that there's enough. Like there are enough resources for everyone, but there are all of these hidden costs in these systems that actually pull resources away from the folks who are most in need. So one of the things across the three systems I look at in the book that came up over and over again when I talked to the designers of this system, is that they would talk about them as systems for triage. And the idea behind triage, of course, being that we're in sort of a national emergency around poverty. There is not enough for everyone, and we have to make these incredibly difficult decisions. So in Los Angeles, there are 58,000 unhoused people in Los Angeles County, and something like 75% of them are completely unsheltered. It is an extraordinary humanitarian crisis. And so the system I look at in LA, which is called the Coordinated Entry System, is very much intended to match the most vulnerable people with the most appropriate available resource. But that doesn't mean that that this system is actually producing more housing. And one of the great folks I spoke to in Los Angeles is this homeless advocate and lawyer, Gary Blasi. And he said, I think really importantly, like, look, homelessness is not a systems engineering problem. It's a carpentry problem. And when I get really afraid about these systems, one of the things I'm most afraid about is that we're using them as empathy overrides, that these are decisions that are too hard for human beings to make, right? I don't want to be the person choosing who among 58,000 people receives access to a home and who has to continue to live in the street. But we don't then want to just punt on that political question of what do we do about the housing crisis in the United States. There's not a single county in the United States with enough affordable housing. I'm afraid sometimes that we're using these systems to avoid those really difficult political questions, that we're sort of outsourcing the most horrifying decisions we have to make to machines because they make us so uncomfortable.
Let's go to Charlie in Madison. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Sure. I'm calling because I work in the technology industry and I actually do implementations of massive call center systems. And the biggest challenge that always comes forward is not the technology, right? The technology can do anything. It's around the implementation. It's the business process. And it's the people, right? Technology implementation, it's people, process, technology. And so when things fundamentally break down in the business process or fundamentally break down with your people resourcing, right, we run into these kinds of challenges. And so I've heard you talk, Virginia, a lot about the macro level and, you know, systems replacing political decisions or deflecting political conversations that we should have. But I guess what I'm wondering is, what is your solution to this challenge, or what do you see as a solution?
That's a great question, Charlie. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Charlie. And I really appreciate your insight from the really important work you do. I would love to talk more about the interrelationship of frontline casework and technology in the business processes. I'm not sure we have time to do that and have me also offer some solutions. So, and I don't want to duck the solutions question. So I'm happy to address that directly. I will say that most folks who want to talk to me about solutions, I've been talking about the book with a lot of people over the last 2 months. And I definitely get the feeling that people want me to give them a 5-point plan for building better technologies. And I'd love to be able to do that. But I actually think we have a lot of cultural and political work to do before we get there. Right. So I believe the first thing we need to do is have like a much needed cultural conversation about the realities of poverty and economic inequality in this country. My hope is more honesty in those kinds of conversations will drive political change that creates public services that act more like universal floors under us all, something more like a universal UBI, universal. Oh, I'm forgetting what it stands for. It'll come to me in a minute. Universal.
That's okay.
It'll come to me. So something that works more like a universal benefit system,
right,
rather than this sort of moral thermometer that we have right now. But in the meantime, we need to. The technology is not going to just wait until we work out this really difficult political and cultural conundrums that we're facing around economic inequality right now. So I asked designers to sort of ask themselves two basic gut check questions. One is, does the system I'm building increase the self-determination of poor and working people? The second is, if this system was aimed at anyone but poor and working people, would it even be tolerated? And for me, those are some fundamental questions that if you can't say yes to, then you just shouldn't be building that system. I believe you're on the wrong side of history.
And in these last 30 seconds that you're with us, what advice would you offer people so that they can see these challenges moving forward? And if they're working in these systems, what would you advise them to do?
Yeah, so I think these systems really act as amplifiers of the inequalities that we're already seeing in our society today. So I think despite the sort of horrifying stories I tell in the book, that the book in the end is very optimistic. I believe we can use these systems as ways to identify existing inequalities, as ways to see our experience mirrored in each other, and in ways of having these really difficult conversations and not avoiding these most pressing moral and political dilemmas of our time. And that's both poverty and racism. So I think we can use these things, these technologies, as moments to have a deep moral conversation as a country. And I welcome that conversation.
Virginia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Virginia Eubanks is an associate professor of political science at the University at Albany SUNY, author of Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. This hour of the morning show was produced by Brianne Chasso and Keely Baltina. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.